Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are strapping ourselves in for what feels like a high-stakes business thriller, but it's actually a memoir. We're jumping into The Ride of a Lifetime by Robert Iger, the man who, well, steered the Walt Disney Company for 15 pretty transformative years.
Yeah, and it's definitely more than just a corporate history, isn't it? It's almost like a living blueprint. Iger's book, it lays out this really powerful argument that, you know, successful leadership today in this kind of chaotic world, it demands this really delicate balance.
A balance between what exactly?
Well, you've got to be a visionary, sure, unstoppable thinking.
Yeah.
But you also need rock-solid operational excellence. Mm. And maybe above all, just the sheer courage to embrace change, to take massive calculated risks.
Exactly. So it's like the ultimate guide for leaders who are facing, well, total upheaval. And why is this so critical right now for you listening? Mm-hmm. Because Iger navigated Disney through just incredible disruption, the rise of streaming, global economic shifts, tech changes that completely rewrote the entertainment rule book. Mm-hmm. So if you want to know how a huge legacy company doesn't just, you know, survive chaos, but actually dominates it, this is kind of the map you need.
And Mapmaker himself is, well, arguably the most influential media exec of the last couple of decades, Robert Allen Iger. He didn't just walk into the top job. His career spanned, what, 45 years? Started right at the bottom.
Right at the bottom. ABC, 1974. Studio supervisor. Making like $150 a week doing basic floor tasks.
And that's such an essential detail, isn't it? He really understood the nuts and bolts from day one.
Precisely. And that whole journey, it culminated in him taking the CEO seat at Disney in 2005. His time there until 2020 was just marked by staggering growth. Almost unbelievable, really. We're talking Disney's market cap growing nearly five times over, from $48 billion to over $240 billion.
It's that scale of success that really sets him apart. He wasn't just like managing what was already there. He was actively rewriting cultural history, buying up some of the biggest storytelling engines out there. Pixar, Marvel, Lucasfilm, and then that massive chunk of 21st Century Fox. And what makes his view so unique, I think, is that he's a practitioner through and through, not an academic, just theorizing. He has this incredibly rare mix of creative sensibility, like he gets why a story works, and serious business smarts. He knows how to turn that art into, well, lasting value. I mean, he was the guy sitting across from giants like Steve Jobs and George Lucas, convincing them, trust me with your baby.
Yeah, and the book itself, it's structured so smartly to reflect that journey. It's doing double duty, really, part memoir, part leadership playbook. Its main goal seems to be showing how principled leadership, that integrity and you mentioned how that's the real engine for transformative results, not just, you know, small wins.
Absolutely. It breaks down pretty neatly into two parts, learning and leading.
Mm-hmm.
The first half, the learning bit, covers those really foundational years at ABC. Details the key mentors who shaped his character, his management style.
And then it shifts gear into leading that incredible 15-year run as CEO. And he doesn't shy away from the tough stuff, does he? He really gets into the nitty-gritty of executing those billion-dollar strategies. Takes you right inside the boardroom for the biggest bets.
Yeah, and across both sections, he digs into, I'd say, four critical areas any leader has to grapple with. First, the whole art of the deal. Acquisitions. How do you bring in these massive companies like Marvel, which was famously independent, without kind of crushing the creative spirit that made them valuable in the first place?
Okay, that's a big one.
What else? Second, the absolute importance of relationships. He hammers this home. How emotional intelligence, building trust, managing complex personalities, that stuff was often more critical than the financials when dealing with Jobs or Lucas.
Right. People first.
Then third, navigating tech disruption. Iger shows that big traditional companies don't have to just sit back and wait to be disrupted. They can actually choose to be the disruptor. And finally, the intersection of business success and social responsibility. He talks about why taking principled stands, even when it's controversial or costs you something, is just part of being a modern global leader.
Okay, let's unpack that learning phase a bit more. Back at ABC, started at $150 a week. How did that early grind really shape him?
Well, he gives a lot of credit to his early mentor, Rooney Arledge. Arledge taught him what Iger calls the relentless pursuit of perfection. And that wasn't about, you know, perfect expense reports. It meant treating every single project, no matter how small it seemed, like it was the most important thing you were doing. That kind of consistency, it builds credibility fast.
Makes sense. But then there were the Capital Cities guys, Tom Murphy and Dan Burke. Their style sounds really different, almost countercultural for that era.
Oh, completely. Their philosophy was built on humility, integrity, and decentralized power, which was radical then. They taught him something crucial. Leadership isn't about pulling every string yourself. They focused on hiring the absolute best people, A-plus talent, and then giving them real autonomy, letting them run with it. They showed you could be tough, demand results, but still treat people with, like, genuine decency.
And that contrast must have been really hammered home later when he moved over to Disney under Michael Eisner. He talks quite a bit about those later Eisner years, doesn't he? Showing the dark side of leadership.
He really does. He saw firsthand how a culture can get poisoned by micromanagement, by sort of pessimism filtering down from the top, how it just stifles creativity, breeds fear. Under Eisner, later on, people seem to spend more energy on internal politics than on actually innovating. Iger saw that pessimism isn't just bad for morale, it's a total strategy killer. It showed him exactly the kind of paralyzing atmosphere he promised himself he would never create.
So, okay, he spent years observing, learning what works, what breaks things. He finally gets the top job in 2005. But there was a lot of skepticism, right? People saw him as the safe internal choice, the TV guy. Mm-hmm. How did he immediately signal things were going to be different? What was the day one plan?
He came in with incredible clarity, laid out three strategic pillars that basically became his North Star for the whole tenure. First, prioritize high-quality branded content, meaning intellectual property IP is king. If Disney owned the best characters, the best stories, they'd win.
And IP meaning stuff that works everywhere, movies, parks, merchandise, eventually streaming. It's the core asset.
Exactly. The second pillar was embracing technology fully, not fighting it, leaning into it. Uh-huh. And the third was to make Disney a truly global company, really push beyond the U.S. market.
Okay, so IP first. And the first huge move on that front was the one that stunned everyone. Pixar, $7.4 billion. And like you said, this wasn't just writing a check. The Disney-Pixar relationship, especially with Steve Jobs, was famously terrible at that point.
Oh, it was toxic. So this acquisition became a masterclass in diplomacy built on trust. Iger didn't frame it as just a financial deal. He treated it like a personal repair mission. He spent ages rebuilding that bridge with Steve Jobs, promising, crucially, that Pixar's unique, kind of wonderfully chaotic creative culture would stay intact, totally preserved. That deal only happened because Iger guaranteed autonomy. It proved his core belief, you succeed by respecting creative talent.
Right. And that kind of set the stage for the next big one. Marvel for $4 billion. Internally, that must have seemed like a huge leap, right? Disney was princesses and families. Marvel was seen as edgier, the sprawling comic universe. How did he sell that fit?
Yeah, there was definitely skepticism, but he looked past the surface branding. He argued, look, both companies are fundamentally about great storytelling and incredibly valuable IP. He saw Marvel's potential to fuel movies, TV, parks, everything. For decades to come, he really pushed it through, driven by that core conviction, innovate or die. It was a massive bet on IP and strategic risk.
Which leads us to Lucasfilm. $4.05 billion for the Star Wars legacy. That felt even less like a business deal and more like, I don't know, acquiring a sacred text.
It absolutely hinged on trust. George Lucas wasn't selling because he needed the cash. He needed someone he believed would be a faithful steward for his life's work. Iger's track record by then, showing he'd protected Pixar and Marvel's integrity, that was essential. Iger had to personally convince Lucas he'd safeguard this cultural treasure. It just proves that integrity isn't just, you know, a nice-to-have moral principle. It's a tactical advantage. It closes deals. Others can't.
But maybe the biggest game changer wasn't buying something else. It was the internal shift, the digital transformation. Iger talks about realizing that the whole traditional media model, especially cable TV, was facing this existential threat from streamers, Netflix mainly.
Mm-hmm. And that led to probably his most counterintuitive, most courageous move, deciding to actively cannibalize Disney's own super profitable cable business, their cash cow. Cannibalization meaning you deliberately damage your current profitable thing because you know if you don't disrupt yourself, someone else definitely will.
That takes serious guts. It's the ultimate strategic gamble. And it led to building Disney Plus and, crucially, that absolutely massive $71.3 billion acquisition of the 21st Century Fox assets. Why such a huge deal then?
Scale. Pure scale. Iger knew that to truly compete head-to-head in the global streaming wars, they needed overwhelming depth and IP, a global infrastructure ready to go, and just massive creative production power. It was an all-in bet, really, based on the near certainty that the old media world was over.
Okay, so pulling back from the specific deals, if you had to boil down Iger's leadership philosophy, what are the, say, three core themes that really stand out? Let's start with that one he seems to demand, optimism.
Yeah, he defines optimism really carefully, though.
Yeah.
It's not just being blindly positive, not naivety. He calls it a pragmatic enthusiasm. A leader's fundamental job, he believes, is to project confidence and hope, because the whole organization takes its emotional temperature from the top. If the CEO is gloomy or pessimistic, the entire creative and operational engine just seizes up, paralysis by fear.
And that optimism, that's what enables the courage piece, right? The biggest risk, Iger keeps saying, is actually playing it too safe. All those huge acquisitions, Pixar, Marvel, Fox, they're all massive risks, but calculated ones. Based on strategic thinking about the long-term value of great stories, he shows that being bold, taking those calculated swings, that's what truly transforms companies. Just making tiny tweaks, that guarantees you get left behind.
And the third area for me, it's that dual focus on integrity and relationships. Iger genuinely believes integrity is like a secret weapon. Why? Because it simplifies things. When you have a clear set of values, tough decisions, whether it's partner disputes or social issues, they become clearer. You have a compass. And sticking to that compass builds essential trust over the long haul.
And the relationship piece is woven through everything. Success with creative geniuses like Steve Jobs, it relies so much on emotional intelligence, on respect. You have to kind of speak their language, acknowledge their unique value. Business, especially creative business, is fundamentally about people, managing brilliant, sometimes difficult people respectfully.
Yeah, and the book is just packed with those principles, often distilled into really potent lines. One I really like that gets at that consistency idea we talked about. Mm. The way you do anything is the way you do everything.
Ooh, that's good. It speaks to culture, right? If you let little things slide, sloppiness creeps into the big strategic stuff too. My favorite quote, maybe because it speaks so directly to that huge streaming pivot, is, innovate or die, there's no middle ground.
Yeah, that just hammers home the existential need for constant evolution, especially in industries changing that fast. And here's one for anyone listening who manages people or recruits. Value ability more than experience. Put people in roles that require them to grow.
Hmm, that really flips the script on conventional hiring, doesn't it? Focus on potential, on capacity to learn, then give smart people big, scary responsibilities to actually help them grow into it.
So let's make these really practical. For any manager listening, how can they apply this? Well, take that lesson from Murphy and Burke. Fight the urge to micromanage. Your job isn't to check every single box. It's to give your team the resources and then trust them to run with the details. That autonomy, that's what unlocks top performance.
Okay, and for strategy, apply that self-disruption principle. Even if your current business model is humming along, maybe you run a profitable chain of stores, you need to be the one actively investing in whatever might kill those stores. Leaders have to be willing to, metaphorically, burn down their own cash cow, like Iger did with cable for Disney Plus I, before a competitor does it for them.
And even on a personal level, for career development, look at Iger starting out. Those menial tasks, he did them with total diligence, enthusiasm. The lesson is simple, but I think really powerful. Just focus on doing the job you have right now with excellence. That relentless pursuit of perfection, it's still the surest way to get noticed and move up.
You know, if I had to pick one final thought from all this, what really stuck with me was the sheer audacity required for that big transition phase. The guts to see that the market demanded you essentially disrupt yourself and then to actually follow through, betting the entire company on streaming while the old model was still making money. That's a rare kind of leadership.
And for me, maybe the surprise was just how central that human element was. You picture this titan of industry closing these massive multi-billion dollar deals. But his biggest leverage often came down to empathy, integrity, building real trust with notoriously tricky creative personalities. He proved that decency isn't just some corporate fluff. It's actually a core strength that drives bottom line results.
An absolutely essential deep dive into a truly remarkable leader and his journey.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.